Hi. Kim asked me this morning, did I want to introduce the speaker? I said, I'd love to introduce the speaker. The catch, of course, is that I just met him 15 minutes ago. So everything that I'm going to tell you about him came from the gods of the internet, and let's just hope they were right. He is a writer, lecturer, and vice president of the Hiawatha Institute for Indigenous Knowledge. He is a graduate of the Antioch School of Law. He publishes in Akwesane Notes, the Syracuse Herald Tribune, and other journals, not also including our own Utica Phoenix, which is how we found out about him. He currently resides in Oneida Castle, but he was born in Hamilton, Ontario, and has lived in Washington, D.C., Chicago, Albuquerque, Toronto, Los Angeles, and Ottawa. With him tonight is his lovely wife, Joanne Shenandoah, who is a star in her own right, called by the Associated Press one of America's most celebrated and critically acclaimed Native American musicians of her time. She's won not only a Grammy, but has performed for the Dalai Lama and Nelson Mandela. So, a little side note. Mr. George Canantino's books include Iroquois Culture and Commentary, Iroquois on Fire, and Sky Woman, Legends of the Iroquois. I wanted to tell you more personal stuff, so I spent the day reading some of his work, and I learned this in an article in Akwesane Notes called How Much Land Did the Iroquois Possess? And this is a quote. Prior to European colonization, the Iroquois exercised active dominion over most of what is now New York State. Of the 49,576 square miles of the state, the Iroquois held title to about 4/5 of the total area, approximately 39,000 square miles. So though we are saying he is our guest tonight, I think it's probably more accurate to say we are his guests. Another piece called from News from Indian Country, What Would a Peacemaker Do? In January of this year. He tells a story of, I'm going to say it wrong, Skenenrahoni? Okay. Who 875 years ago gave instructions to the Iroquois to abandon violence. And in the article, our speaker asks, what would he do now? And he ends up answering his own question by saying, one thing is clear, he would act. And I thought that was a particularly appropriate thing for this gathering, because while we call ourselves the big conversation, and while we want to listen and talk and discuss tonight, our ultimate goal is that you will take what you've learned here and take it out into the world and act on it in some way. Lastly, just because it sounded interesting to me, I read a piece called The Importance of Names. And in this piece, he writes, speak the truth, use the name, empower the people. So without further ado, I give you Mr. Doug George Canantio.
Well, it's a privilege to be here in the territory of the Onondaga, the people of the Standing Stone, the Oneidas. And in accordance with our Iroquois customs, our first responsibility is to extend a great thanksgiving to the natural world for bringing us here together in good mind. We acknowledge that all the elements of Mother Earth have given us tremendous gifts, have given us the life from that we take from her. And it is only good that we acknowledge that everything from the earth beneath our feet to the animals that walk about, to the animals that are in the water, to the medicines and the trees, to the winds that caress our Mother Earth, to the thunder beings whom we heard a few days ago have returned from their sleep in the west, to the our eldest brother, the sun, to our grandmother, the moon, to those stars from which we came and those stars to which we will go once our time on this earth is completed. To those people who are our instructors, our teachers, our elders, to those prophets, there are four spiritual beings who guide us throughout our time on this earth, and every once in a while they take human form and give us a sacred instruction, remind us of our duties upon this earth. We acknowledge all the things, the mysterious things that lie beyond our time on this earth. We acknowledge the Creator who so loves us that all the things that we need in order to be happy upon this earth are here. And it's our duty to protect those things, and a cardinal rule of the Iroquois that we must consider the effects of our actions, both personal and collective, on those yet unborn up until the seventh generation. And that in accordance with our rules, that we do nothing that affects their rights, that they have rights, absolute rights, as much as we do. They have a right to walk upon this earth. They have a right to cultivate its soils. They have a right to drink of its waters. They have a right to breathe clean air. And it's our duty to make sure that nothing we do qualifies those rights. Such is one of the cardinal rules that guide those people who follow the ancestral teachings amongst the Iroquois people. And by definition, we are people who were not so long ago part of that vanishing American idea that Aboriginal people at the time of contact in 1492, there were upwards of 120 million Native people in the Americas, and in what is now called North America, anywhere from 10 to 15 million people living in all types of cultures, but living throughout North America. There's literally no place in North America that Native people have not been or made use of its resources. So we have, let's say, 12 million people, which is conservative. When the Europeans were trying to make settlements in the 16th century, they encountered a population along the eastern coast that was, in their description, teeming with human life. When active colonization began, after being deterred for almost a century because of Native resistance, in 1620, a group of people arrived in what is now Massachusetts. And instead of meeting Native people who were vibrant, Native people who were enjoying all the benefits of a continent that was just without exception the most beautiful place on earth, and they found a land that was vacant of human beings, that there were only the scattered remnants of what had been very sophisticated, very complex human societies. And it was the introduction of communicable diseases that enabled the colonists to gain a foothold on the eastern shores. And as they made their way west, it was always that disease that was the primary definitive element that enabled the colonists to overwhelm the indigenous people. Contrary to the myths that have been spread over the past few centuries regarding the so-called primitive conditions under which Native people existed, we know that we were a people that were mechanically inclined, that we were a scientific people, that we were a people who had developed great political and spiritual philosophies, that we were an engineering people, that we were people engaged in specific sciences like urban planning and economics and besides politics. But all of that was obscured when these waves of diseases swept through our communities. Now, if you recall in your own history, for many of you, in the 14th century, certain activity took place that revolutionized life in Europe, that changed forever the conditions under which most people lived. It brought about the end of feudalism and the rise of modern nation states. And of course, that activity was the Black Plague. And the Black Plague had come from Central Asia and made its way through the Mediterranean and gradually overwhelmed most of Western Europe. And estimates are from anywhere from 50% to upwards of 90% in some cases, in some communities, a mortality rate. Now, the same experience in North America, where you would have 90-95%, sometimes almost 100% of a given people eradicated by these diseases. And you can imagine the effect it had on Aboriginal people. So what the Europeans encountered when they engaged in formal colonization of this land was a semblance of what had been before. And people simply trying to gather together the scattered remnants of their former selves and make sense of this situation where those people who were most entrusted with preserving our heritage had died. You know, the elders who in our society were highly venerated and were critical elements in the continuity of our teachings, when those people were taken from us. You can imagine the effect, the psychological and social effect, when you have an alarmingly high degree of infant mortality, when the newborns, those gifts from the Creator, were taken from us, and that we had no way to respond to this. And so, of course, there was a great, great, tremendous change taking place within our societies. And before we could regain that former position, the colonists began to intrude. The effects of that have yet to recover from. So by the year 1900, when I said there was anywhere from 10 to 15 million Native people in North America, by the year 1900, in what is now the United States, there were less than 250,000. And in amongst the Iroquois, you know, where we had once been the preeminent native power in eastern part of North America, we were reduced in what is now called New York State to about 6,000 people. And whether or not we would survive was again subject to great speculation. And in my home community, the Mohawk community located on the St. Lawrence River, just a little bit northeast of Messina, it's called Akwesasne, and it's home right now to 15,000 plus people. But at the turn of the century, we were down to less than 1,500 people. And the last wave of disease had gone through our community in the year 1906. It was a cholera epidemic. And again, it left a deep imprint on us. But we managed to endure. The Iroquois managed to prevail, to survive. And by the time the 1920s come around, we are in a place where we're beginning to reassert ourselves as distinct peoples. We begin to engage in political activity and acts of defiance. Beginning with our rejection of the 1924 U.S. Citizenship Act, which unilaterally imposed American status on Aboriginal people. And we thought about that, not very long, but we did think about it. And then we sent a strongly worded letter to the federal government saying that while we appreciate your consideration for to becoming Americans, we cannot. That we are citizens of our own nation, that we have responsibilities and duties accordingly, and that we cannot, as independent peoples, accept citizenship because it is legally impossible for citizens to enter into treaty with the United States, with another country, with its own country. You simply can't do that. And there was something more, even more profound there, is that the great question is, why would Native people reject all the benefits and the things that come with being an American, or a Canadian for that matter, because the Canadians had followed suit. Why do you want to hold on to these old systems, primitive practices, these elements of paganism? Why would you want to do that? Well, the reason is because it's compelling, because there's a good because our way of approaching reality and our cultural teachings are not only relevant to ourselves, but the manner in which we have developed a unique relationship with other species and with the planet itself is something that ultimately all humans are bound to adhere to follow. That's the key to survival for a species. And so we still have something of great importance to share with other human beings. And one thing that remarks the Iroquois mind is that we do not believe we are a tribal people. We believe that we have a legitimate voice within the affairs of all nations. And it was that assertion that some people would misinterpret as arrogance, but to us it was a continuance of the original instructions given to us at the time of creation. And so we hold on. And remarkably, here in the 21st century, that of all native peoples in North America, if you were to take a tour from the southeast to the northwest, from California to Maine, and even enter into Canada, you would see that of all peoples, the ones who have retained the essence of a separate, unique identity are the Iroquois. And in my home community of Akazesne, there's been a determined effort to retain language as well, when just a generation ago they said all Iroquois language were virtually extinct. But we have adopted contemporary technologies, and we have faced the consequences of making that fatal compromise in terms of cultural continuance. And we began to relearn our ancestral language and carry on with these teachings. And there are things that do make us distinct. And I'll give you a quick background prior to discussing the topic for tonight, which is the doctrines of discovery and how that has affected every one of us, every citizen, every resident in North America and Mexico, all the way to Tierra del Fuego, has been deeply affected by those papal bulls issued in the 15th century. They are the legal means by which our people see each other. They have defined our respective realities. But the question is, what kind of people did the Europeans encounter here, in amongst the Iroquois? And I was talking at Hamilton College yesterday, and the students there in the class were mostly from other places, other nations. I'll give credit for Hamilton for soliciting those students from Africa and from Asia, from Europe. But what I was concerned about was this, is that Hamilton College had done nothing whatsoever to recruit Native people, Native students. And if you know the history of Hamilton College, you know that it was started by Oneida people who wanted to find a means by which they could sit and learn from each other. And that the key advocate for that was Shenandoah. And it was originally called Oneida Academy, and its charter requires that institution provide for the educational needs of Native people. So I asked in the room how many of those people had even encountered any Native person at Hamilton College. None of them had. Does Hamilton College live up to its most sacred agreement, the thing that defines itself as an institution? Well, it doesn't. And it was my wife's ancestor who made land available to Reverend Samuel Kirkland in order to establish that school. And it was supposed to be a place of common learning. And it was supposed to be a place where Iroquois people could teach as well as learn. But it didn't do that. But we were able to at least go through some of the overall themes that define Iroquois reality. And I was emphatic to the students that they have to understand that Iroquois, the way we begin, is feminine. It is, we created a society where the people we call the life givers, the women, enjoyed the highest degree of personal liberty and freedom of any society that we know of. And that was deliberate, and it begins with where we came from. So in you have to understand that the myths, the cosmological events that gave us our identity in order to understand our politics, which again is a preliminary to our relationship with the United States. So we begin here. And I assume some of you drive Subarus, correct? Anybody drive a Subaru? Well, you look on the back of that car, it has a cluster of stars, correct? In a Japanese, that refers to this. This is the home. This is where we came from, our point of origin. It's in the Pleiades star cluster, which is gradually fading from the horizon. But it's most important to us because that is where we came from. And upon our demise, that is where we go, back to the Pleiades. And we are told that at a certain time, an event took place in which an entity, the next slide will show us the star paths that we take once we leave our bodily systems. So we go on this star path and we go back to that. And at the point of death, they would also, one of the things that the people who encountered our ancestors would remark upon was the Iroquois had absolutely no fear of death. That we do not have an eternal hell, we don't have a heaven, we don't have any elements of coercion. What we try to do is divide a society where the human mind was in a state of liberation and could think. And again, without having to worry about these kind of irrational punishments that existed if we didn't follow a certain doctrine. We don't have an organized religion in the European sense. Whatever we believe about the spiritual beings and about morality is woven throughout all elements of our society. We do not have a priestly caste. We have no castes. And one of the great things that we accomplished was that a society without having those artificial divisions amongst human beings, instead everything was shared in common. And our first entity, is, of course, a female. And that, think about that, and how that, right away there's that distinction. In the biblical telling of the great story, it's almost always masculine. And it begins in Genesis when it has reference to man shall have dominion over the earth and all the fishes and everything else upon the earth. That one word has led us to this current state of impending ecological collapse because it treats this as a commodity, as a masculine element, as a thing that could be bartered and exchanged. And in Iroquois thinking, that is impossible. You can't sell the earth no more than you would sell your mother. Nor could you treat the earth in a way that would bring her harm. She has the same psychological, spiritual, legal presence and importance amongst us so that we see her as our mother in a very intimate, personal way. And then in our deliberations, within our guiding principles, we always acknowledge her first. She always has standing with us. that's how important she is to us, which is why at the time of encounter, when you came to this part of planet Earth, you could go anywhere in Iroquois country and you wouldn't find any, undue stress upon the earth. There's no polluted streams. The forests were great, beautiful forests And the animal life was without exception the most diverse and rich of any place in North America. And that was all by deliberation. So our people thought about this and devised a society that was based on empirical analysis of the world around them, and also a healthy dose of common sense. You know, common sense tells you you don't destroy the waters of the earth that you need in order to drink, sustain yourself. Common sense tells you that you don't cut all the trees because you need the trees for your for food. You need the trees for shelter. You need the trees in order to provide homes for other species of life. So we designed a political and a cultural system that was based upon that. But it was also one that was deeply rooted in a sense of where we are geographically and the point of origin, and I make a strong emphasis on this, has nothing to do with the Bering Strait. There are certain myths that are woven and within the American story, the American native. And one of those great myths that is meant to displace, undermine, and trivialize Native history is that we are migrants and that somehow we came from Asia and somehow we made our way through these great massive ice flows, because the Bering Strait theory can only exist when you have the Ice Age with this tremendous glacier that is covering most of what is now Canada and reaching as far south as Cortland, New York. And somehow human beings made their way across thousands of miles and made the perilous trek and reached this part, Alaska, and somehow managed miraculously after leaving Central Asia. Why would anybody do this in the first place? But they would find their way over here. And somehow within a very short time of 12,000 years developed the most sophisticated set of languages on the earth. People will have you believe this, but it's not true. So my job is to dismantle these myths, right? And so those myths won't stand in the way of us understanding each other. And so we have to do away with this, and we have to tell you that Native American point of origin is exactly where we say it is, and that the latest genetic testing affirms that Native people have DNA that is truly unique in the world, and that the shot before that with all of the nations let you know the diversity of cultures within this land, and that there are people who attack the idea that Native people were ecologists, but you know, more objective science tells you that in fact human beings did manage to secure a state of cultural stability based upon principles that are intimately tied with the right of other human with the right of other species to exist. And that's where we are here, but our point of origin is right here. See, in the Rio Grande area, for any of you who have been in Albuquerque, our linguistic cousins are the Hopi and the Tewa peoples. And they're so we met with them and we said, well, we know where we came from. We came from here. Where did you come from? And they said, well, we came from here, this place. And there is a story about how humans came from here in a land that's inundated or underwater and made their way to the highlands of Nicaragua. And from there went south and then from, also came up this way. And we're waiting through the archaeologists to actually listen to us. And as they make their discoveries, they're beginning to find that, in fact, the point of origin, the myth of origin, the legends of origin are sustained by physical evidence. But it's hard to get beyond that story, you know, 12,000 years old. And we say, if anything, Native people went this way, like, you know, the horse and the camel, or first in North America, and then they made their way to Asia. So we say, why not think about it in that context? But you know how hard that is for people to make that psychological break? It is really difficult. So we go to the next, and we'll go through this fairly quickly. Our longhouse people, we were lived collectively. All our resources were shared in that famous saying that that sends terror down the spines of capitalists, you know, from to each according to need, from each according to ability, that came from here. We didn't have a class structure. There was no rich and there was no poor. Everybody ate, nobody ate. Everybody was warm, nobody was warm. And I mentioned that yesterday to the kids. I said, you know, think about this. The Iroquois had such a profound effect on your lives and you don't even know it. That there were two great philosophers in the 1900s, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. And I told them those two guys had as much effect on human history as Muhammad or Genghis Khan or Jesus Christ. And their idealism, you know, the thing that compelled them was when they read about the Iroquois. And I was just telling Joanne today, I was reading more remarks by Karl Marx about how he was enamored of the Iroquois. So here was a society without having the artificial divisions, without exploiting the workers, where women existed in a state of balance with the males, without organized religion. And he called it primitive, but not in a negative way. He meant that human beings could live in a condition of ecological stability without exploiting each other, without resorting to warfare. Now here's the fundamental question that Karl Marx posed, and we suggest that today. Are human beings qualified by this endless motivation towards organized warfare? Is that part of our DNA? You know, is that who we are? Or is there something else? Can that approach to resolving human conflict be directed another way? Is it possible to live in perpetual peace? And some people will tell you, well, that's a little bit idealistic. We cannot create a society where people are free from strife brought about by warfare. But in Iroquois society, we were as close as human beings have ever come to that. And one of the ways we did that is by designing our society in order to secure the rights of women in whenever any element, whenever any concern was brought up by the community that involved life nurturing, life taking, life giving. It was the legal prerogative of women, and men had to answer to the women when it comes to those issues. When it comes to economics, women control the economic vitality of the Iroquois people. They were the ones who distributed the results of our collective work. And it was women that held title to the earth as much as title can be held. It was women who decided how human beings would interact with the natural world. And it was women who controlled the planting and women who oversaw the harvesting. And if you were a man, well, you were there in order to supplement the feminine, to protect women, to add your physical abilities in order to create stable homes for women, to watch out for the children. That's not to say that it was a life without strife. There were instances involving capital punishment, for instance. In an Iroquois society, there were three things that if you were involved in these things, that the women could decide to terminate your life. One was murder. The second was any kind of physical assault on a woman was a capital crime. And the third was any assault on a child. The women would get together in council, and they would, if the person could not be reconciled with the victim, and then the person's life was extinguished. We do not believe that in some instances a person should be allowed to continue to cause harm and disruption within our societies. And so it was up to the women to decide that. So next one. This is our longhouse today. Now the miracle is we still continue with our ancient ceremonies. There are 13 that follow Grandmother Moon. And each cycle of the moon, we have a different ceremony. This is who we are symbolically, so you can tell us by the adornment, the male hat, and of course the Mohawks, being as arrogant as they are, have three upright feathers. And the poor Tuscaroras have none. But the other ones, this is how you define us. This is who we are, according to our teachers, people of the Great Hills, people of the Pike, people of the Hills, the original hillbillies, the Onondagas, people of the Standing Stone, not Turning Stone, not Rolling Stone, Standing Stone, people of the Flint, and the Tuscaroras, the shirt, people who wear the shirts. They came from, they are Iroquois people who left us many, many hundreds of years ago, went to North Carolina, South Carolina, and then had a war with the English and found their way back up here, and they became the sixth member of the Iroquois Confederacy. But stories, and this one is very important. This is Cohoes Falls, in the second largest falls in New York, that where the Mohawk River, just before it meets the Hudson, and on top of that bluff there, it's about 170 feet up, is where our peacemaker, the person we call Skunalahawi, he created the Iroquois Confederacy, and he encountered the Mohawks there, and they told him that in order to prove the validity of his teachings, that they were going to put him on a tall pine tree and then cut the branch on where he was sitting, and he would fall into that falls. And if he was valid, he'd come out of that unscathed, but if not, then he would disappear. And he came out of that falls. The next morning they encountered him to the west of the village smoking his pipe, completely unhurt, not even his buckskins were wet. And they accepted and embraced what became known as the Great Law of Peace. And then what he did is he decided that in order to get people to work with each other, not against each other, he would create a system based upon clans or large families. And that these are the nine clans of the Iroquois people. And what these do, what this clan thing does, is that it only provides us with the means to distribute common goods. It also means that it enables us to have a direct, very intimate, personal relationship with the natural world. So that if you're a member, like Joanna is of the wolf here, or let's say one of her grandmother was of the beaver, then that's the animal, that's your name, that's your identity. You take care of that species. You know, you make sure that that wolf is healthy and has the means to fulfill its duties. The same with the eel and the turtle, the snipe and the hawk, and all of them have a legal standing. And what we're trying to do is convince the nations of the world to alter their constitutions to reflect the inherent rights of other species equal that to ourselves and equal to that of what is it called, that decision he made a little while ago that allowed the corporations to become humans. Citizens United. Well, if you can do that with Ford Motor Company and Amazon, why can't you do that with Mother Earth? Mm-hmm. Now, you think that's impossible, but it isn't, because Bolivia has done this. They amended their constitution to give Mother Earth legal standing in their courts of law. And that goes against the doctrines of discovery. This is how we see each other. It's a little bit out of focus, I'm sorry about that. But there are 50 strands here that stand for the 50 male leaders, and behind them the 50 female leaders. How we reach resolution is by consensus, but that doesn't mean everybody agrees. What it means is that everybody puts their minds together and try to do what's right by the people, and then you have that a specific arrangement. Now, if we had about a day or two, I could tell you how this works politically. And this isn't the ideal. Right now, the Iroquois are under a great deal of stress. This does not apply to all of our communities, because we're now separated and distinct. And unfortunately, the ideal is something we have yet to completely realize in our generation. But this thing that existed, this democratic institution based upon our relationship with the natural world, where men and women lived in a state of gender equality, wasn't an illusion. You know, it existed in time, in space, and it was the most powerful entity in Eastern North America at the time of contact. You go. This is Coho's Falls way. It used to look, before they put a dam over there, redirected the water to the a power plant. This is our territory, the way it was up until the American Revolution, and then where we live now. We once had over 26 million acres of land, and we're reduced to less than about 80,000 right now. So we're in a very, we live on very limited space. And of course that was Cristobal Colon. And here's where our story about tonight's topic begins. And that is Colon, as you know the story, his heritage is subject to a great deal of debate. Some people will say he was born in Genoa. Other people say that he was born in Barcelona. Wherever the circumstances of his birth, he managed to persuade the Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand to finance his expedition westwards. Now, they had to have some assurance that there was a profit to be made from this, and that if this individual went westward the way he proposed, that he would ultimately return. And so what he did is he presented them with physical evidence that there was a group of European sailors on the north shore or north part of Spain called the Basques. And the Basques had been cultivating the cod's fishery grounds in Newfoundland for many, many years. And that they would land on the shores of Newfoundland, dry the catch and bring it back to Spain. And so they knew that there was a land presence there. He'd also been to Iceland, and he knew from the stories there that there was this land mass. He also knew that there was this current that if he went in a certain direction would ultimately take him back to Spain. And that's finally what convinced the Spanish sovereigns to agree to finance. Now, there was the money issue. Where would they get the money to pay for this expedition? Well, they got it because in 1492, certain events happen in Spain. One is they're able to overwhelm the last Muslim community in Granada and expropriate their property. And the second is they made a decision to expel the Jews. And while Cristobal Colon is in the port in western Spain, literally next to him are ships full of Jews whose property has, like the Muslims, been taken by the crown. And they're using that wealth stolen from these people in order to finance his trip. He arrives after 6 weeks on October 12, 1492, the greatest event in contemporary human history, or the last 2,000 years anyway, takes place. Not because this man is a great man, but because we have the first permanent meeting of two very distinct societies. And the question that they had was, what do we do in response to this people? And they knew, as they gradually began to travel in different directions, that this was a hemisphere populated by millions of people who in many cases lived in urban societies that were far larger than anything in Europe at the time. That they existed, as Colon would remark about the Arawak people he met in a state of paradise, that he thought maybe these people are somehow children of the Garden of Eden. But they lived again in a society quite distinct than that of Europe. So his question that he brought back when he enslaved those native people to Spain, to Barcelona, was, what do we do? The Bible makes no reference to these people. What place do they have within this new age? Well, the papacy was then controlled by a pope named Alexander the Sixth, the Borgia Pope, and that he was Spanish, and that decided that he would examine this issue and make a papal edict, a papal bull. And he knew that 40 years before that, in 14, 14, 1452, Pope Nicholas had sanctioned the taking of land, property, and in fact, the physical lives of people who were considered non-Christians. The Portuguese were involved in expeditions that were leading them into Western and Central Africa. And so they needed a legal, moral basis on which to enter into those territories and then take these people captive and bring them to Europe. And so he came up with the idea, based upon Roman principles, that they were the other. You know, because they were not Roman, they were considered in a state of perpetual conflict with Rome. And that Rome had certain procedures that they enacted, physical procedures. And a Roman, one of the Roman priests would accompany a Roman military unit. They would approach these people who were considered hostile. They would say certain things in Latin to that group, and then they would hurl a spear in the direction of that group. And that they would then ask the people if they accepted the authority of Rome. And if those people who did not speak Latin, who were not aware of this ritual in any way, oppose the taking of their lands, then the Romans would consider that warfare, justifiable warfare, and use all of their power in order to subdue those peoples. Well, in 1452, Pope Nicholas had the same situation. You know, here are this new thing. How do I respond to it? So he reached back in history, he dusted off those Roman practices and told the Portuguese royalty that if they wanted to do this, there was justification for it. But they needed to go through the formal procedures. And so they began to first exercise this against the African peoples. And so in 1493, Alexander VI decided he was going to supplement that by sanctioning the papal bull issued by Pope Nicholas V. And what would that be physically? Well, what it meant is that if you encountered a non-Christian people, then they were, by definition, because they were not Christian, they'd been denied somehow, under some strange circumstances, the teachings of Christ, they were then the enemies of Christ. And if they were the enemies of Christ, then you could use force in order to affect their conversion. Well, that's in a spiritual, religious sense, but underlying that, of course, was the economic initiative. Europe was beginning to expand. It needed greater sources of material wealth, and these people might have had access to that wealth because they were finding trickles of that metal that drives Europeans crazy, even to this day. Because European society, in the Iroquois way, is defined by a heavily emphasis on the masculine. And when I started, I said, we give thanks to our elders, brother, the sun. What is the sun? The gold. And they would see this, and it would drive them insane. We are people of the moon, and Iroquois and others place much more emphasis on silver than we do gold. But, you know, so what Colon did is, after he had this permission by Alexander VI, the most corrupt pope in amongst a very long line of corrupt popes, he was the worst. We all know his personal habits, you know, his solicitation of women, his fathering of illegitimate children, his absolute arrogance and treating women as simply things to use at his pleasure. Wait, that's not, this is 2018, isn't it? Holy mackerel. You know, the guy looks like, they look alike. You ever seen a picture of Borgia, the Pope? He's got that same bloated face. And anybody that lacks a fundamental respect for women in Iroquois law is unfit to hold office. They would be physically chastised by the women who would take these long willow sticks, and they would whip them. They'd make them run the gauntlet. That's how much power they had and how severe the penalties for doing what the current president of the United States does to women. Alexander VI follows the same thing. Anything that derives material wealth, he can rationalize. And so what Colón brings to him is, bits of gold with the promise of more wealth to come. So he gives him the umbrella on which he can take native land, but he has a problem, and that is with Portugal, because Nicholas V had already given this authority to the Portuguese, and Alexander VI, beholding to the Spanish sovereign, ran into a conflict. So they worked out a deal. It's called the Treaty of Tordesillas, signed on June 7, 1494. And what that does, again, enormous implications for each one of us, because it takes the world and it says everything beyond a certain distance west of Cape Verde Islands, everything this side east belonged to Portugal, everything that side belonged to Spain. And they realized that as they began to define the Americas, that was an inequitable relationship. So they revised it later. But what it did is the reason you have a Spanish-speaking people in South America along this line, and then you have Portuguese in Brazil over here, is because of this treaty, because this is what the Pope ordered. That the Portuguese then wound up claiming most of Brazil, and the Spanish had the western side of the hemisphere. But it also affected all other Christian nations. So even though there was a schism brought about by Alexander VI, nonetheless, the Christian powers in Northern Europe adopted the same principle. And the basis of every law to this date, when it comes to native, non-native relations, is the papal bulls, the doctrines of discovery, every law, every social program, every education initiative, every land use agreement is defined by the doctrines of discovery, because what it says is the Christian power has ultimate authority over Aboriginal issues. The Christian power, whatever that power is, whether it's Canada, United States, Mexico, or Costa Rica, if they are Christian, they own the land, and natives have the right of occupancy. But that occupancy can be extinguished without recourse at the pleasure of the sovereign. And in 1923, the U.S. Supreme Court is trying to figure out how do we deal with this Indian situation where they clearly are sovereign peoples because we signed treaties with them, the supreme law of the land under Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, but how do we deal with them? So they came up with this fabrication, this crazy idea that the United States government owned all land and that Indians could only live on that land. Indians did not have subsurface right to those lands. Indians could only live there, and their title, their occupancy, could be extinguished again at the pleasure of the United States federal government. In Congress, the Supreme Court handcuffed itself by said it did not have the authority to overturn any formal act by Congress and signed into law by the president regarding Aboriginal issues. In 1957, this was affirmed under a ruling called Tahitian versus United States, in which Alaskan group challenged the assumptions of the doctrines of discovery. And then, lest you think this is ancient history, 2005, something really bad happens, is there's a group of people who are empowered because they're deriving wealth from the Turning Stone Casino. They take our collective rights, the rights of all natives, the rights of every Iroquois person, and by themselves, they separate from the Confederacy. They go into the Supreme Court, and I wrote columns about this, telling people what was going to happen. You take this thing in the Supreme Court, and then you say that you're going to cite 25,000 homeowners as potential defendants in this case, what is the Supreme Court going to do? They're going to kick your rear end. There's no way they're going to displace American citizens, taxpaying citizens, in order to honor a treaty or return the land back to Aboriginal people or enhance the status of Native nations. They're never going to do that. And so they lost. City of Sherrill versus United Indian Nation, 2005, the majority opinion, all nine justices, was written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg. To her great shame, as if she forgot what happened to her ancestors in Spain, she affirms the doctrine of discovery. She says that this terrible law enacted by this corrupt and terrible regime in Rome applies right now in our time. Absolutely stunning, but predictable. We knew one of them was going to do it. We thought maybe Clarence Thomas one of the other right-wing justices, but for Ruth Bader Ginsburg to do this, and there's a program coming on that elevates her to quasi-sainthood, but for her to do this to us, the original peoples of this land, to extinguish our rightful claims to territory that was taken from us based upon the doctrines of discovery, is a legacy, I think, that's well worth reminding her of. And somehow she obscured Article 6 of the Constitution of the United States. She just took it and simply forgot about its provisions. So that's where we are right now. We're still holding on. I gave you the very rough outlines of who we think we are as Iroquois people, why we maintain our claims to a distinct society, despite the enormous pressures upon us that are right now even perhaps even mortal in our case, far more dangerous in some instances than the plagues that devastated our communities 110, 115 years ago. But we are in that situation right now, that precarious situation, but we're still holding on. And we're still engaged in acts of defiance. We're still challenging the doctrine of discovery. In November, we're going to go to the World Parliament of Religions in Toronto, and we're going to ask that collective body, the greatest gathering of spiritual leaders on the planet, the Muslims and the Buddhists and the Jews and the Christians, we're going to ask them if they will join us in a motion to rescind the doctrines of discovery. And then we take that motion, we go to Pope Francis, and we say, this is the collective will of all the spiritual people on this planet. And then we'll ask the Catholic Church to begin the dismantling of the doctrines. And when that happens, all the precedents in U.S. law, all those Supreme Court rulings are moot, because they then have no basis in law. And it revolutionizes everything. And hopefully it'll compel Canada, United States, to begin dealing with Native people with the degree of respect and that's supposed to be part of their own requirements under their own constitution. So we're hoping that'll initiate that discussion. And so that's where we are right now. Now, I know you have a lot of questions about this, and I've gone on a little bit long. So if we can talk about this, if you'd like to, if you'd like me to respond specifically to anything happening here, whether it's amongst the Oneidas, I'm not Oneida, I'm Mohawk, but I'll respond to the best of my ability. So if you have questions, just throw them forward. Anything? Go ahead. Oh, you got three people. The guy in the back. We'll start there.
I read recently that part of the history of slavery that's not talked about is that Europeans actually enslaved Native American people before they enslaved African American people or Africans.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could speak at all about that.
Sure, the use of, or the exploitation of people of color, especially Africans, again began a few decades before the encounter with Aboriginal people. And that was the basis under which Nicholas V issued his first papal bull. And that was meant to rationalize the taking of property in the lives of people from Africa, and then use them in order to supplement the needs in Europe. So it began with the Africans. But when they came here, they found that the high degree of mortality that was connected with the enslavement of native people, you know, they learned that in Haiti right away, because Haiti at the time of contact was populated by anywhere from 2 to 4 million people, just that island alone. Within two generations, those people were virtually extinct. They were down to 30,000, I believe. And so they had to supplement it somehow. And so that began the cross-Atlantic slave trade, because they believed that African peoples would survive and endure when natives would not. But certainly slavery of native people was part of that deplorable condition and heritage. It's part of that history. And it continued on into the mid-1830s and 40s, when native people were enslaved in order to feed, house, and clothe the people in the Spanish missions in California. It continued into our current times, when native kids, native boys and girls, were taken from their homes, and the parents had no recourse, but the federal government in both countries would come take native children, put them into either foster care system or in a residential school system, and then you were subject to strict standards when it comes to cultural appropriation and then physical labor. And I know that because I was one of the last group of Canadian natives that were put through that process, and it was nothing short of enslavement. You had no personal freedoms, no right to dissent, not even the right to demand decent food. So when I watched that film, Oliver Twist, I believe it is, Oliver, when he goes up to the guy and he says, "Could I please have some more?" I understood that, because we were held at our calorie intake in a given day was far less than what we needed to do things that we did. And it was always a desire for a little bit more, always that edge of hunger that characterized institutional slavery, wherever it is. And certainly that was the case in my experience. But slavery, yes, was a factor in Native life. Along New England especially, the English were great advocates for organized slavery, and certain native populations like the Pequots in Connecticut, they were absolutely decimated, first by disease, second by organized warfare, the third by slavery. And in recent years, they've made attempts to reach out to their biological relatives, most of whom were shipped off to the Bahamas and Barbados. And they still have the shadow of a native identity in those islands, but that's who they were transported to. So you can read the narratives, you can see that slavery was very common in North America amongst native people into the 1700s. So it was a factor. Yes, Oren?
Struck by, I've been reading Alan Taylor's book, history. I've been rather immersed in it, but at the same time, I'm rather immersed in studying anarchism, and the Iroquois organization strikes me as being very similar to the beliefs of anarchism. I mean, there's kind of the belief it is essentially that human nature is essentially cooperative.
Yes,
that we work together.
Yes,
that an injury to one is an injury to all.
Yes.
That we, and it's beautiful.
Yes. Yeah, we don't have the principle, we don't have the things that would harness our emotions. Like, you know, when I was on my res, I was baptize a Catholic. You know what baptism is, right? The act of removing the taint of original sin. Now you consider a baby born into this world as tainted with that. Already you're crippled. You're under a heavy burden, a spiritual and psychological burden. But in Iroquois society, we elevate the children to be good, and especially the girl children. You know, when you have a girl child, it's such a wonderful thing because the life exists and it'll continue on for the next generation. So that alone, you know, marks a significant departure in how we see ourselves and how we see our relationship with the natural world. And you're mentioning this new scholarship that's coming on. It's not because these people suddenly developed a new sensitivity towards Native people. It's because we, for years, have been telling these people, mm-hmm. you cannot continue to perpetuate these myths because they're hurting us and they're hurting you. Mm-hmm. There's a new scholarship that you have to adopt. And we've been lucky. We persuaded people to do things that are really revolutionized. You know, there's books like Lies My Teacher Told Me. There's this excellent book that shows you how we change every facet of your daily lives, that Indians are not casual, but we produced the world's greatest diversity of crops. Virtually everything you eat or wear comes from Native people, and not casually. Native scientists, Native biologists, Native herbologists who devise these things after years of study. This book should be in every school in New York State, but I guarantee you it's not. Mm-hmm. And it's written by K. Mary Porterfield because she was influenced by the Iroquois, because we told her this story. We're more than just canoes and lacrosse. We're far much more than that. And so we have this book. We have this amazing one, Jack Weatherford, who has a series of them, beginning with Indian Giver, and he analyzes this. And the title is tricky, because who's a savage and who's a civilized? And when you read this book, you get an idea of the complexity of Native life. You read Charles Mann's 1491, that tells you how humans did shape the earth to fit their specific needs, but it was possible to do that without destroying the land. And 1491's absolute brilliant scholarship. Here again, Indian Givers. This should again be required reading to every grade 7 and 8 student, because it'll change forever their perception of Natives. And this, the story behind this is Houston Smith was the most preeminent theologian in the United States, a man of great wisdom. And he was teaching at Syracuse, and I took his class. And so I'm listening to Houston, who's telling me all these great stories about the Upanishads and Bhagavad Gita and the Bible and the Quran. In the end, I have to talk to him, Houston, what's missing here? There's no absolute mention of Native people anywhere. Millions of Native people that are somehow outside the circle of your knowledge. You don't understand them, because you're concentrating on what's considered the established faith. So he began to meet with Native people. I introduced him to the Onondaga Nation, and he changed his whole attitude towards Native people. He became instrumental in passing the Native American Freedom of Religion Act. And in his book here, this is the best written book on religions anywhere. He actually, you know, devotes an entire chapter to what he calls the primal religions. The primal religions. And so what it does is it enhances people's understanding of Native spirituality mm-hmm. in a way no other book has. But Houston Smith is a great personal friend for Joanne and I. but you can change things by personal interaction. If you find the right person under the right conditions, you can affect great change. I'll tell you another story. And that is our great friend, the chairman of our Hiawatha Institute, is a guy called Les Lobal. He's Navajo, and he graduated from Georgetown, and he's given an internship with Senator Alan Cranston, who was a liberal Republican from California in the early 70s. And Alan goes into a room, he sees Les is there, and he's in the point of despair because he's reading this article on National Geographic about the impending extinction of the eagle. And why that's happening, because there's this unchecked despoiling of the habitat of the eagle. So Alan Cranston sits next to him and he says, "Well, Les, do something about it." I says, "Les, what can I do? I'm an intern." And he says, draft a law to protect the eagle and the other birds, and I will shepherd it through Congress. So Les Lobol, this young 22-year-old, drafts the Endangered Species Act, and Richard Nixon signs it into law. And then he thinks, well, that works pretty good. So he does another one, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act. And then Alan Cranston introduces it in Congress. It becomes law. And it has changed the whole dynamic of American culture, because suddenly there's this new sensitivity towards what we're doing to other species of life. And now there's a concerted effort, sad to say, to dismantle those protections. That's taking place now. And I just wrote an article. I have to be very emphatic here. This is your year of decision. You know, you have an obligation to stop this from happening, to reach out to Schumer and to Killebrand and anybody else, that to stop, if nothing else, at least stop the dismantling of those basic laws that have enabled us to at least see some of the species revive and to breathe clean air and clean water. Well, this is the year which it has to stop, if it isn't stopped. And he is successful in nullifying those statutes, then the consequences, you think April's been bad for Utica. Mm-hmm. You hold on to your hats, because it's going to get worse. It certainly is, you know, our living entity, Mother Earth, is not going to take very much more of this. You know, things are going to change. So, you had another question over here?
I just have a question. Last fall, I was at a panel discussion at SUNY ESF, and Neil Patterson, Tuscarora, yeah, was talking about what we can do.
Yes.
And he suggested, so if you have 40 acres of land that someone's given to you, why don't you just give it back?
Yes.
And he mentioned something, I think this was afterwards when I was talking, about wouldn't it be great if there were a Haudenosaunee Land Trust?
Yes.
Do you have any thoughts about that?
I was involved in the formal Mohawk Nation Land Claims Committee for many years. We were trying to negotiate an arrangement with New York State that would enable us to expand our existing land holdings without going into court, which only is adversarial, and ultimately we knew we would lose. And we felt it was our duty to do whatever we could to have that land returned to our active jurisdiction, but conditional, depending upon our legal obligation under our traditional law to care for that land, in trust for the species that lived on that land and for those yet unborn. Mario Cuomo saw this, and I had some arguments with that fella, and he was not impressed by that. He saw us as an impediment, and he had a goal that he would do, two goals. One, that he would neutralize the Iroquois, because we hold underlying title to this land, to most of New York State, has never legitimately been sold or otherwise turned over, that every one of those land agreements is contrary to Article 6. He knew this. He also had another goal, and that was to expand organized gambling throughout the state. So he figured a strategy that if he could persuade the weakest element amongst the Iroquois to offer to sell land in exchange for gambling options, that would neutralize us, that would work, that would create internal divisions and prevent us from acting in accordance with our ancient laws.
Never changes, doesn't. George Clinton did the same thing.
George Clinton, and it worked. Mario Cuomo's strategy, and I read the letter that Bob Batson, his lead attorney on Indian issues, gave to George Pataki, and it said that if we could find this weakness amongst the Iroquois, we could then exchange land for gaming compacts. Well, that came to pass. And so gaming has been this great distraction in our society. And you have to know that those, you know, it is something that is highly controversial, and that Iroquois Confederacy has repeatedly rejected organized gambling despite the need for some kind of way to alleviate the poverty on many of our communities. It simply doesn't work. And it exploits the natural world.
and the Turning Stone Casino was built on wetlands. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these things, that's the way it is. We are in the state of internal contradiction. And Neil Patterson and others are advocates for the traditional approach to living. But they're at odds with many Iroquois people who see sovereignty as a way to gain an economic edge. So that's where we are right now. So you go in our community, you're going to see these contradictions. But the beauty and the thing that demands our attention and our admiration is that still the essence of this Iroquois philosophy based upon natural law still has somehow managed to exist into the 21st century. So we are going to World Parliament. We do go to these international assemblies, and we address this.
Oh yeah.
Oh, and on Friday, music is the thing we use. You know, we've always used music whenever we lack the means to talk to each other, understand each other. Music is the thing that defines the movement of the universe. Each one of us has a certain rhythm, a certain key. And today I had they monitored my heart, and I'm listening to that. And I'm saying, you know, this sounds exactly like the movement of the earth. If you ever take a microphone, and you can do this online, you can listen to the earth. And by golly, it sounds just like the movement of a human heart. The same pattern, the same key. It's astounding. But it's also affirmation of those traditional Iroquois principles that tells you that Mother Earth is a living entity and demands our respect. So Neil Patterson, yes, we created the Hiawatha Institute, a 501c3, because we didn't want to go to the courts. And so far we have 3 land grants. We own that land as much as it can be owned above Cohos Falls, where the Peacemaker was. It was returned to us in September of 2016, the first time in modern Iroquois history this happened, without rancor, without anger, everybody loving it, no enemies, even the politicians loved it. And then we had 2 other land grants near Canton, New York. So if my response to your question is to the Iroquois is simply, we don't want to go to court. We're going to lose, ultimately, we will. And so let's form an education foundation. And then land can be transferred, tax exempt, to the native entity like ours, Hiawatha Institute. And then you could put conditions on it so that, you know, it's protected for all time. That's how we do it. So Neil was right, and we have done it. And we will continue to do it. So anybody that has any land, but Friday at Cheryl in, where, Joe?
Gethsemane Episcopal Church.
Gethsemane Episcopal Church at?
Cheryl at 7.
At 7 o'clock, we're going to have Joanna's going to perform there. And if you never heard her music, it's life-sustaining. And Gethsemane is really interesting because Joanna and I were there in Israel when we had a chance to visit. And we had a chance to look at the what they call the Golden Gate, eastern part of Jerusalem, the one that will be open when the Messiah returns. And then we found out that there are actually some groups, fundamental groups, that are based in the U.S., but they're working with the Israeli government to affect the opening of that gate and the return of the Messiah. That is actually really happening. So, things you learn. But anyway, you had a question?
One thing.
We can have one more question.
Okay. Yeah. This is more a comment than a question. My maternal grandmother is from Oneida Nation in Cheryl. My maternal grandfather was actually Mohawk in Canada.
Oh, must have been a handsome man.
Very interesting. I have a lovely picture of him. However, my comment is this. Not until the last 10 years,
yes.
I'm talking over 50 years, I have no clue of any of this history,
yes.
Not spoken by family.
No, it wasn't.
Never did we touch upon this in school.
Never. It was.
Thank you so much.
It was deliberate.
I recently listened to the Grandmother of the Turtle Clan.
Yeah.
On Onondaga last month.
Yeah.
Wonderful presentation.
Yeah.
All this and how much the indigenous people impacted the women of our nation.
Well, here's a, you know, I guess we have to come to a, we have to put out the campfire, but here it is. You know, all of this was actively suppressed by the school system and by the church and the government as a whole. up until the late 1960s, to be a Native was an act, it was not something that very many people took pride in, because you had suffered oppression and the residual guilt. So you must be tainted, you must be wrong, you must be bad. Otherwise, why would all these people say you're bad? And so it did not become a good thing to be Native, literally, until we had a teacher. His name was Ray Fadden. He was Scottish and Mohawk. And he brought in a simple thing inside his school in social studies classes on the reservation. And he told the Mohawk boys and girls, and they're 10, 11, and 12, you know something? You're good. You come from a good history, good people. Now, what I want you to do is go to each one of your grandmas and your grandpas, get their history before it fades away, bring it back here, and we're going to write about it. And he did. And that simple act soliciting our history based upon the attitude that the children actually were good, revolutionized Native politics on my community and around the world. Because it's from that teacher that we get the core of what becomes the Native Rights Movement in the 1960s. And we get the Iroquois delegation to Geneva in 1977, the Human Rights Tribunal, and then we ultimately get the 2009 UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. That all came from here, the Iroquois. And that alone, once it's enacted by all nations, will mean a tremendous change in our relationship to the natural world. And it's beginning with Bolivia, and it'll spread to other nations, and hopefully we can get the next Congress to not only endorse the UN Declaration, but enact it into law. And if we can do that in tandem with the Pope Francis revoking the doctrines of discovery, then the great change happens for the benefit of all of us, every one of us. Every American will see a tangible benefit once Native people and our rights are acknowledged and our culture is free to flourish once again. So thank you for being here. We'll see you on Friday.
Thank you so much. I think it just fits in so well with what we're doing in this series. And I think that this the reclamation of that history, which we're speaking now, is so important because it's so necessary that we change our assumptions. It's so necessary that we realize what the neoliberalism that we're operating on now, that it's Thanatos, man. It's death. We are on a path of death, and we've got to get back on a path of life. That's what this is about.
Yeah. Thank you. All right. Thank you.
And you, even music.
If there are people who are interested in doing a workshop, an experiential workshop on the doctrine of discovery, myself and my partner Drew have been trained to lead these. They're basically for allies, not necessarily for Native people, so that we can have a little bit of experience of what the doctrine of discovery is. So if anyone's interested, let me know.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Great job.
I'll choose one.